Accession number 8225, rule number 2.
Mr. McCausland, reel 2.
I was about then a couple of hundred yards behind them because I'd left them. And there was one of them, heavy machine gunners, sitting on the ground, Cheshire. And he said to me, "Your chaps are going over that piece of ground there. The Germans all shell that very heavily at this time of day." And I ran, I've never run faster in my life to try to stop them. And I ran and I got to the head of the column where Andrew Longstaff, who was the squadron commander, was marching away, and I told him this. And he said, "Well, I can't be bothered with that," and he marched straight on. And the Germans didn't shell it. And I went back, and that was the first time they hadn't done it. So we were very lucky.
What happened next?
Well, after that, we settled down to Anzio, and I must explain, the battle had finished because the Germans attacked and attacked and attacked, and then they stopped because they couldn't get anywhere. And the reason they couldn't get anywhere, we had such a weight of artillery that it was the artillery that stopped them. It was the shell fire that stopped them. They couldn't manage it. And it was a perimeter, and my division was on the left-hand side, the coastal side of the Anzio perimeter, and opposite us were the 4th Parachute Division, who were extremely fine troops. Indeed, they're very good. I was at regimental headquarters, and I slept in a dugout, which is about the size of 6 feet by 3 feet kind of thing, underground, with lots of sandbags on top. And it was fine, except that when it rained, I got soaking wet, and it wasn't much fun. But otherwise, it was all right. The squadrons were in trenches further forward. We were the divisional reserve position, again, in a relatively easy position. But we could be seen most of the time by the Germans from higher ground, so you didn't operate at all during the daytime, or not very much. I mean, there were only limited places in which one could move. But everything came awake much more at night. And all the days are more or less the same, really. You spent most of your time forward, and we had a few days leave in the base areas. All the whole of Anzio could be under fire, and often was. I went to the dentist once, and it was an American dentist, a major, with a very pretty nurse in a tent. And he put me in his chair, and he started to try to take out a tooth. And he pulled, and he pulled, and he pulled, and nothing happened. And I said to the nurse, "I think I'll go to another dentist." "No," she said, "the major's a very fine operator." And then they produced a bottle of whiskey, and the major drank most of the bottle of whiskey. And then some shells started to fall, and they lay on the ground and left me in the chair. It was a horrible experience. It was very funny.
Were you in much pain?
Yes. Yes, I was. I got my tooth half out. Anyhow, he did get it out. But I seemed to have trouble. I had to go twice to the dentist stands here to get stoppings and things. The back areas were rather interesting because you had notices everywhere, "Dust means death," which meant that if you raised any dust, the Germans could see it and they would fire at it straight away. And that wouldn't bother you because you would have gone on, but it would bother the troops who were actually there. So you didn't move fast in a jeep or anything like that, and you move very carefully so as not to raise dust. And there were also great pictures of Jane, who was the Daily Mirror pin-up girl, who hadn't taken her Mepocrine, I think it was, which you took for malaria, a yellow pill, because it was a fairly... The Pontine Marshes were on the right, and though they're supposed to be drained, they weren't really. And there was a danger of malaria. Actually, the mosquitoes ate the Mepocrine, we thought. But nonetheless, you had to take it. And I think it was court-martial offence to go down with the malaria. I've forgotten about that. Anzio was very tough for most of the people in the forward areas there, not so much for us. And the whole sort of attitude of people was much tougher than it was anywhere else. And I was horrified, we had one quite good trooper, whose name I've forgotten, who missed the boat for Anzio, and he was court-martialed. He got drunk, I think, and he was given 5 years. I prosecuted, and I thought he'd get 6 months or something, and I thought that was very tough indeed. An officer of ours, a good officer, had gone on leave, and he came back in one of these American barges, and it was bringing beer for the American troops in cans, and they offered him a can of beer, and he drank it, and he was court-martialed for theft, and I defended him, and he was found guilty and sentenced to be reduced to the ranks. Actually, we appealed, and he got off. But he left the regiment. I didn't see him again. It was a tough attitude to what you did there.
Do you think it was necessary?
No, I don't, actually. Because all the troops that I met were good. Everybody was trying very hard. And morale was very high. It was very high with us. And we were a good regiment. We had a good colonel. And it was... And certainly, I mean, the regimental attitude wasn't like that. It was the higher-ups' attitude, really. No, I don't think so. I don't think it was necessary. But when I... The worst place was a place called The Fortress, which I think has been written about. I think a chap called Raleigh Trevelyan wrote about a book about it. And also there's another book, which I read last week that I hadn't heard of before, called Rough Ride to Rome by... a chap called Sir David Coe, who also writes, he was in my, both these people were in my division, and they both wrote books about the, what happened. They're very good, actually, and very truthful, though I don't like Raleigh Trevelyan's attitude. It's very difficult to say what it was really like at the time, because we were very light-hearted at the same time as being very tense. And you can't do it unless you are. I mean, I remember once that I and a chap called Bill Alexander, who, he was a very good lieutenant, he'd been a colonel in the Spanish Civil War on the Republican side. We were in a little hole in the ground, slit trench, because you lived in slit trenches, really. And one of our troopers came along, and it was shelling, and he tried to get there, and he was being shelled, and he tried to get in. And we said, go away, it's full up. And he looked absolutely horrified. I'd never seen anyone look so horrified. And that was not actually because he was frightened at all, because that wasn't the way the officers ought to behave. And we made it, and so we let him in, because it was a joke. And actually thought it was quite funny later on.
Can you tell me some details about your reminiscences of this Bill Alexander? We have a recording by him about the Spanish Civil War, so it's a bit interesting to us.
Have you? How interesting. No, I can't really. He was a troop commander, and I think he got promoted later on, I can't remember. He was a very nice man, I liked him very much. He was a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Great Britain at the time. He didn't indulge in any communist propaganda at all. I mean, you wouldn't have known he was, except he said he was. He was just a good, pleasant chap, and we all liked him.
How did he perform as a soldier?
Oh, very well. He's very good.
Did his Spanish Civil War experience tell in any way in his soldiering?
No, I mean, I don't think so. I don't think he was any different from anyone else. But what he did do at the end of the war, in Germany, everyone was given jobs, if they wanted them, after the war was over, between being demobilised. And he went round to the nearest equivalent to MI5 and got a job catching communists, which he kept for a fortnight just for fun and then gave it up.
What happened next?
At Anzio, well, it was a routine, really. Again, I did the same as I'd done in Galliano. I sent men from the intelligence section out to the squadrons, and then I went to every day to see them. Some of them were easy to get to, some of the squadrons, some weren't. There was a thing called the lateral road, which ran just behind our positions. It was a road, long straight road. And there was a place called La Cogna, on the other side of it, which was a ruined little village and farmhouse, and we had a squadron there. And to get to them, you had to, actually, the daylight, you had to roll across the road. And I remember once, several things happened to me at La Cogna. I can remember one extraordinary thing. I saw a man in British uniform running in the open, and you didn't do that because, I mean, you couldn't be seen. if you moved at all, you crawled. And I shouted at him, and he disappeared. And I wondered what that was, and it wasn't one of our men. And I thought perhaps it was a German, because the Germans had been sending patrols through our lines. They stopped one of our ambulances. That's a fairly well-known story, so I won't go into it. And there was a culvert under the road, which was a great big one, about 4 feet wide, and then it branched at the end. And I'd never been up there, and I thought they were probably hiding there. So I got a Tommy gun and went up there, and when I got halfway up, it was very long. It was about 20 yards long. When I got 10 yards up, it seemed a lifetime. My courage failed me, and I crawled back again. And actually, the Germans, I think, were there. So I wouldn't be here if I'd gone on further, because they could hear me coming. What happened mostly was there was intermittent shelling, there was mortaring. I used to have to cross a field which was flat, not visible to the Germans, but star marked by mortar shells, to get to one of the squadrons, and that always frightened me. And on one occasion, I was shelled by a big gun. There was a big gun called Anzio Annie, which we were all rather frightened of. But I did think it was that, I don't know. Anyway, I was in a sort of big slit trench thing with a sergeant and some men. And I sent the men down, and the sergeant down to the dugout, and I stayed in the thing, in the trench, and looked out through the periscope, in case it was heralding some sort of attack, was covering an attack. And I was really frightened. I've never, ever been so frightened in my life. Because the shells, they didn't hit the trench, but they landed quite close, and they blew boxes of Bren gun ammunition, which it takes two men to lift them, about the trench, the blast did. And that frightened me. And when the sergeant came up to see how I was getting on, I lay on the ground in between the when the shells were coming, I lay on the ground, and when they'd stopped, I got up and looked out. And when they were coming, I was lying on the ground, and my legs were absolutely trembling like this. And his were not, which was very shame-making. But I couldn't do anything about it, whatever. There it was. And the funny result about that was that next day, I couldn't bring myself to walk over this star-marked field to the squadron.
What marked field?
It was marked like stars, the mortar bombs. A mortar bomb falls and goes whoosh sideways. It doesn't, it's not like a shell, it doesn't go up, but the metal goes parallel to the ground a few inches above it. And I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And I went a very long way around through a little defoliated wood, and I was shelled by an 88mm gun. And when I got to the squadron, the second ground squadron, David Edmonds, said, "John, you're late today. Why is that?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know. I just thought I'd be late." But I remember sitting with my head in my hands for about a quarter of an hour trying to force myself to go over that field, and I just couldn't do it. But one recovers from that. Morale is interesting, I think. People who haven't seen much action are no good. You get very good for a little while, and you're quite light-hearted, and then you get depressed. Every regiment, every person who's been in action long enough eventually becomes depressed. I didn't have any very serious action at all. It wasn't like the infantry or anything like that. But I did find, this at the end of Anzio, I was getting quite depressed. It didn't affect the way one behaved, but it was fun to begin with, and it really was, actually. I mean, one enjoyed it, but it ceased to be fun later on.
Why did the depression normally come on?
If you had 30 or 40 fairly serious car accidents, one after another, you would start to feel depressed. It's like that. I mean, people got killed, you escaped, and you didn't know that you were going to next time, and so on. It is depressing, I think.
Was there anything you could do about it?
No, there wasn't. What makes it better is you take a few days out of the line, and so on, and then you're all right. But then it comes on again. I found I was never... in Germany later on, I wasn't nearly as light-hearted as I was in Italy. I enjoyed the Italian campaign. And it seems a silly thing to say that I did, but I didn't enjoy German language. And we were not, and I must stress this, we didn't see any serious action compared to the people like the infantry who were in far worse positions and had a far worse time.
Why should the German campaign have been less enjoyable?
I've seen enough action. Anyway, every day was more or less the same in Anzio. You stood to an hour before first light, and then you stood down, I think, about an hour, a little bit after first light, because that was a relic of the First World War. In the First World War, Germans used to attack at dawn, and so we stood to at dawn, which meant you didn't get much sleep, because you first light before, and then you had usually something happening during the night. You were on the troops were on patrol or watching what was going on, because at night things happened, and so you spent the day dozing or cleaning weapons, or we had a sense of the men's mail. I always got books sent to me. It was very good. And cigarettes. Rothmans sent me cigarettes, Turkish cigarettes, which I smoked. And I read books by Virginia Woolf, because it seemed so very different from the kind of life we were living and what civilization was about, all this fuss about absolutely nothing all the time, which all her characters indulge in. And that seemed to me what life should be like. And I don't think that anything particularly memorable happened at all to me. Before the breakout, we knew we were going to break out at some date, I've forgotten when, towards the end of May. And I went with Ambrose, who was then adjutant, Ambrose Hancock was then adjutant, to see the infantry who were going to be on our right for the breakout. And I remember we went through a little wood, and suddenly we were fired on by a heavy machine gun. And I lay down, and Ambrose got into a slit trench. When I say I lay down, you throw yourself on the ground and you're fired on, fired as hard as you can. And this machine gun fired about 3 inches above me and went on firing. I put up little sticks, and the sticks were broken. And Ambrose was in his slit trench and thought it frightfully funny. I didn't think it was funny at all, actually. And because I was thinking, I remember thinking then, that if the machine gun digs itself into the ground just by that much, the tragic to be lured, and that'll be the end of me. But in fact, it stopped. And what he was doing, he was covering the retreat of the German infantry. And he was firing continuously on a fixed line. I think it was the 3rd of June, we broke out from Anzio, and we went up the coastal road to Ostia Antica. The idea of the campaign was that the army on the mainland would break out at Cassino and along the whole front. We would break out a day or two later, and the German army would be trapped between us and the army on the Gustav Line. That is the 8th and 5th armies. It didn't happen like that at all, because Mark Clark, who was ordered to advance eastward from Anzio, Mark Clark commanded the troops in Anzio, didn't do it. And without telling Alexander, he moved towards the Alban Hills in order to try to take Rome on his own. And so the bulk of the German army escaped. It was a dreadful thing to do. We were told when we were going to Ostia that we were going into the killing ground, which didn't encourage me very much. But of course it didn't happen like that. And we started off with hordes of photographers and journalists. I'd never seen a photographer or a journalist in the war before, but we had about 8. And we went along. I went in the colonel's car, and on the first day, we ran into a little ambush, and I was really totally exhilarated. I've never been like that in my life before, and never been like it since. What happened was that we went round a corner, and we were fired on by a machine gun, and the driver backed very skillfully around a little hillock thing. If you did that didn't normally happen. If you were fired on your back, you normally ended up in a ditch upside down and you were dead. But he was very good, and I remember the colonel stuck his head out of the car with his steel helmet on, crawled up one of the squadrons, and you could feel bullets whistling all around you. And I hadn't got my steel helmet, I'd lost it. And he said, "John, put your steel helmet on and get down." And I just grinned at him. I've never felt like that. And then I got out of the car and I walked along the road and the squadron came up. And my exhilaration had evaporated by that time. But for about a couple of minutes, it was really wonderful. So it was a slightly difficult time in the car because the colonel was under the impression that I would read the map for him. I couldn't read a map. I had no sense of direction. And another of my disadvantages was I couldn't see in the dark at all. So the war for me had times when it was extremely difficult. He didn't know I couldn't read a map, actually, and we didn't get lost. But I was rather worried about that. Then we settled down on the 3rd of June, sort of halfway to Rome. It's only about, I don't know how far it is, it's only about 20 miles, I think. But it was very wooded country for most of the way, and the Germans cut down trees across the road and things like that. And by the time you got rid of all that, it took hours. And there was a little bit of opposition, as I said, but not much. One place we came to, the food was hot on the plates of the Germans. They'd had mess plates with food hot on it. And they'd just gone the second we arrived. Then on the 4th of June, the next day, that's the day Rome fell, the colonel dispensed with my map reading services, quite rightly, and I was in my own armoured car. And when we got to Ostia Antica, I thought it'd be nice to loot Rome. I mean, it's ridiculous, but I really did. And my driver was a chap called Faulkner, who claimed that he'd been a smash-and-grab man, the driver of a smash-and-grab gang in peacetime. I don't know whether that's true or not. That was his story. But he was a very nice chap and very brave. And he thought it would be an excellent idea. So instead of... I was totally alone. You see, I had nothing to do then. So instead of stopping at Ostia, I turned east and I went towards Rome. And I got... I don't actually know how far in, but I got quite a long way into Rome. And I saw absolutely no one. No civilians. No troops. Nothing. This was about, I think, about 4:30. And the official thing is, the Americans got in at 7:30. Mark Clark said no one was allowed into Rome except Americans. The British troops would be shot if they went near Rome. And a patrol from my division of the Green Hards got in at 6:30 illegally. And I reckon I got in at 4:30. And I wasn't quite in the centre. We got quite a long way in. Then I turned around and I came back again because I had second thoughts. Common sense actually crept in. And I went back to Ostia and I found one of the troops putting up the statues there and shooting at them, starting to shoot at the machine guns, with a very agitated curator trying to stop them. And they took no notice of him at all. So I stopped them doing it. And I think that's quite the most useful thing I did during the whole war.
Was it just out of devilment or what?
Oh, no. Things don't mean anything to you. I remember that's the thing that I thought was one of the lessons I learnt during the war. That things didn't mean anything whatever. It was people that counted. I've revised my opinion about that now. As one gets older, one acquires things. But basically, of course, it's true. No, it wasn't. I mean, they were good things to shoot at. They were people anyway, you see, so they were the right shape and size. Well, that... was the end of Italy for us, because after Ostia we were taken back to Palestine. I remember looking across the Tiber when we got there, a great broad river with one boat on the other side, and wondering if we couldn't possibly get across somehow, but we obviously couldn't. After that we went back to Palestine, which we'd been to before, and we guarded the High Commissioner, Sir Harold McMichael. He was a very difficult man to guard because Mr. Begin, who was there primed a little while ago, was trying to blow him up. And McMichael didn't like being guarded. He had a fast civilian car, and we had slow armored cars, and you used to disappear, leaving us behind. And then you would come back, and they'd say to you, "What? How did it go? Well, we lost him." And nobody was terribly thrilled with that. But Palestine, I thought, was a bit boring. I didn't like it. But you used to go to the Lebanon, to Beirut, for leave, and that was simply heavenly. It really was wonderful. I didn't do it, but you could ski at Ali in the mountains and water ski in the sea in the same day if you wanted to. And I must tell you about when you got to the town, you were sent to the transport officer or whatever he's called, I can't remember, and he would allot you a hotel to stay in. And junior officers like me didn't go to the grand ones like the Saint-Georges and the Normandy. We went to cheaper hotels. And I was sent to one called the Mimosa. And that was very nice, very pleasant. And there was a green baize door, and I went through it. And there were rows and rows of girls in horse boxes with nothing on at all. And actually, a lot of people seemed to be in there. We've got a friend who's now a high court judge, and he said he was there. And we had a wonderful dinner party. There was me, an ex-solicitor, this high court judge, and a stipendiary magistrate. And we'd all been to this place, and the stipendiary magistrate said, "I made my fortune there. I stood on the side of the green baize door, and when the young men came out, I said, 'I know your father, and I shall tell him unless you give me £5. But I don't suppose that's true. Anyhow, it was really huge fun. I enjoyed that very much. Then we were told that we were going to Northwest Europe, and we got on a Canadian lake steamer at Alexandria, and we steamed across the Mediterranean. It was frightfully rough, really most unpleasant, I thought. And the man, the captain, said it was going to sink all the time, which didn't encourage me. But I played, it took quite a long time, took 2 or 3 days. I played bridge most of the time. I played it with a captain who had 7 wound stripes, and if you got 7 wound stripes, you're obviously a masochist, so I thought he'd lose at bridge, and he did, and I won £50. So that was very satisfactory. Then we landed at Marseille round about Christmas. This was Christmas 1944.
How did you get to the actual war theatre?
I'll tell you that. We went up in a big train, and you went in, it was like 1914 things. They were these carriages with nothing at all except wooden floors and a roof, and you lit a fire in the middle, and bought eggs from the French and wine from the French and so on, and we went up like that, and it was quite fun. Then we went to Gand, or at least not Gand itself, villages near Gand, and we were stationed there, and we were told we were going to Holland, which I didn't want to do very much because it was very cold and wet and unpleasant, fighting in the polders, or whatever they call them. And I was stationed with a Belgian family, and I was terribly impressed by how kind and nice. They were a working class family, and they were really, really as kind as they could be. But we didn't actually go to Holland. We were sent, we didn't really know what we were doing. I didn't know what we were doing anyway. I was then second in command of a squadron, and we were sent over one of the Arnhem bridges, you know, the Battle of Arnhem, and we saw all these gliders and everything all ruined on the side of the by the bridge. I don't remember which bridge it was now, but it was one of the 3 bridges. And we went over there, and we